Comics Ate My Brain Weekly Roundup podcast. I'm Tom Bondurant, and this week we've got a short list for September 2nd, 2009, including Agents of Atlas number 10, Batman number 690, Justice League Cry for Justice number 3, Strange Tales number 1, Supergirl Annual number 1, and Wednesday Comics number 9. And in fact, let's begin with Wednesday Comics number 9. About all of the strips that I liked in the book this week can be found on the front page. Batman, Commandy, Superman, The Flash, Green Lantern, and then one on the back page, Wonder Woman. The Batman strip by Brian Azzarello and Eduardo Risso is basically Batman beats up a big goon, but that's done with the appropriate amount of noirish style, and fits pretty well into the overall story, which, as I've said before, is sort of an exercise in noir cliches. And there's Commandy, Dave Gibbons, writer, and Ryan Sook, artist. The real strength of Commandy, and I'm not saying that Gibbons is not a good writer, because I've enjoyed the scripts, but I think the real achievement of Commandy is in Sook's evocation of the immensely detailed backgrounds and landscapes, the Prince Valiant style of adventure comic strips. And this is certainly on display this week as Commandy goes to Washington, D.C., and or the ruins of Washington, D.C., and Sook is just giving a tour de force pretty much every week. The Superman strip by John Arcudi and Lee Bermejo is something of the same kind of thing. At least this week we get an explanation for Superman's extreme emo tendencies throughout the course of the strip. And, of course, last week and this week have started to build up to, you know, more straightforward Superman action. This is essentially about a handful of very large panels in which Superman sort of lays out the fundamental problem he has with the bad guys. I mean, by problem, I mean the thing that's been plaguing him that the bad guys have caused. And so it's just it's a lot of space used on exposition, but it's pretty-looking exposition nonetheless. The Green Lantern strip, more action by writer Kurt Busiek and artist Joe Quinones, building up to an alien invasion, which should be a nice showcase for Green Lantern's abilities. And then the Flash strip, which I liked a great deal, finds Barry working through his psychological difficulties by hallucinating himself in various comic strips, including, you know, Peanuts and romance-type strips, other soap opera-style strips. And it's a lot of fun, especially since Charlie Brown-style Barry has a monkey for a pet instead of a beagle. And then the Wonder Woman strip is getting more into straightforward sort of heroic quest territory. And not that I didn't appreciate Ben Caldwell's attempts at innovation early on, but, I mean, good grief, they got awfully confusing and intricate. And I wish they'd come across a little bit better. Oh, and the Supergirl strip by Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor just continues to be almost unbearably cute. So, all in all, another fine issue of Wednesday Comics. Shame there's only three more to go. And then there's Justice League Cry for Justice number 3, written by James Robinson and drawn by Mauro Cascioli. This issue is essentially the origin of Prometheus, who is the villain who's chained up on the cover. And it's got its problems. For one thing, we find Green Lantern and the Atom torturing Prometheus in order to find out, you know, essentially what his plan is, and incidentally working out some of their own frustrations with their inability to prevent the deaths of Batman and the Martian Manhunter. Oh boy. And I don't know. It seems like the kind of thing which, if this is sort of the dark night of the soul of Hal Jordan and Ray Palmer, then that's one thing. But if this is, you know, the way things are now, and this is setting the stage seriously for the way they're going to act in the Justice League of America book once Robinson takes it over, that's another. I mean, let's put it this way. There were moments in James Robinson's Starman series which were dark nights of the soul. I'm thinking specifically of Whatever Happened to the Ragdoll, which, you know, was this dark secret involving various members of the Justice Society. And that was alluded to as, you know, a very bad thing in capital letters, which happened a long time ago and which, you know, we don't talk about now. And it occurs to me that if this is the same sort of thing, like if this is going to be just a very bad thing that happened in the lives of Green Lantern and Green Arrow and the Atom, then if they are going to get past this in time to rejoin the regular JLA book, why are we seeing it now? You know, isn't there a better way to present this without sort of impugning their otherwise good reputations here in real time? And the answer to that, of course, is this Cry for Justice was originally going to be a second Justice League title, and the art was probably already most of the way done, and DC, you know, always loves putting out painted comic books because it makes them seem more adult and whatnot. So there's no way that this story was not going to be told in the format that it currently enjoys. But it's one of those things, again, that I have to wonder, you know, if you really want to tell happy, straightforward superhero stories, why aren't you telling happy, straightforward superhero stories and just, you know, using these grim and adult moments as kind of seasoning, like you did with Starman? There's another thing, too, about Supergirl wanting justice for the death of her father, which happened last year in real time in the run-up to the whole new Krypton thing. And that seems really... I'm still not entirely clear on the chronology of this book, but it seems kind of fuzzy given that Supergirl has other ways to work through that in the regular Superman books, and I don't know that she especially needs this Justice League group to help her through that. I suppose the art is decent enough. It's certainly not as stiff as it was in the first issue, but I didn't like it as well this issue as I did last. Cascioli gets to draw basically one extended action sequence involving Kongorilla, Starman, and some killer robots and the Blackhawk plane that they appropriated last issue. And that works out okay, but I think the overall effect of the painted art combined with Robinson's uber-dramatic prose just lends this book a weight, you know, gives it a too serious tone that it really has not earned. I mean, you know, DC doesn't care one way or the other about what I say about this, and I'm probably going to see this through to the bitter end. But the execution so far has been fairly uneven, and, you know, things like these grim-faced torture scenes don't help matters at all. Next up is Strange Tales number 1 of 3. It's Marvel's version of something that DC's done a couple of times called Bizarro Comics, in which Marvel asks respected independent and alternative comics creators to draw offbeat takes on iconic Marvel characters. And it's really, really funny. I mean, there's stuff like Johnny Ryan drawing the Punisher as a kind of an after-school special life coach. Paul Pope drawing a Lockjaw story in which Lockjaw, never gets fed because the Inhumans are always rushing off to fight Maximus or, some other super menace. It opens up with the Watcher, masturbating in front of his computer because he has to watch everything. There's Dash Shaw's Doctor Strange, which is, quite a lot of fun, especially if you're familiar with Shaw's work. Jason draws Spider-Man story in which Peter confronts the fact that he's never been in a bar fight. And there are a couple of Nicholas Gurwitch one-page strips that are, everything in here is really, really very funny. Well worth your time. The couple of things, maybe the less successful stories in here are a She-Hulk story set in sort of the 19th century, looks like, where She-Hulk marries Man-Wolf. That, I don't know, nice idea, just kind of falls a little short. That one was written by John Levitt and drawn by Molly Crabapple. And the art's nice. I just think the jokes didn't work as well as they maybe could have. And then Junko Mizuno draws a Spider-Man story where Spider-Man and Mary Jane have to fit into a town full of actual spiders. And again, that's a little that one was a little too weird for me, but what do I know since I am not that conversant with the alternative comics that the kids today like. Next up is Supergirl Annual Number 1. This is actually, I think, the second Supergirl Annual Number 1, but we won't get into that. I mean, it's the first Supergirl Annual Number 1 in at least about 10 years. Anyway, it was written entirely by Sterling Gates, penciled entirely by Fernando Dagnino, and inked entirely by Raul Fernandez, but it contains two stories. One focusing on Supergirl in her new secret identity of Linda Lang, Lana Lang's niece. And the second is the secret origin of Superwoman, who is in actuality Lois Lane's sister, Lucy Lane. And the Superwoman origin story, or I should say, sort of the secret origin of Lucy Lane, I thought was pretty good. I hesitate to call it poignant, but because I have some questions about it. But essentially, Lucy was always number two and sort of treated like it by her dad, General Sam Lane, who is the prototypical Great Santini kind of, you're not advancing unless you're hurting, kind of dad. Always more happy with Lois than with Lucy. Lucy has to take odd jobs like becoming a stewardess and, or excuse me, flight attendant. Finally, Lucy joins the military in order to impress her dad. Yada yada yada. Ends up volunteering for a secret government experiment and becomes Superwoman thanks to this government-created superpower suit. So there's that. The question that I have about it is, Superwoman died rather publicly a couple months back, and I am wondering what she doing here in this issue. Anyway, Annual leads off with the Linda Lang spotlight, which is there was a period there, I guess, where Supergirl was distinguished from Superman because she screwed up a lot more than Superman did. And lately, this creative team of Sterling Gates and regular artist Jamal Igle have tried to show that she's not that big of a screw up anymore. But, and I'm not going to say that this is a return to form, but this is kind of another example of Supergirl meaning well and actually maybe making things worse. I won't spoil the story for you because there are a couple of twists and turns in there, but I thought it was a nice secret identity story. You don't see too many secret identity stories anymore. You don't learn a whole lot about, say, the difference between how Linda Lang presents herself and how Supergirl presents herself. But again, it was more of a good secret identity puzzle type story, and I appreciated that. Dagnino and Fernandez turn in a nice-looking annual. It looks a lot, if DC kind of has a house style, it fits in very nicely with that. Colorist is, can't quite read it. The colorist is Blonde. That's his or her name. Well, his name, I guess, because Blonde doesn't have an E on the end of it. And, I don't know, it looks a lot like the regular Supergirl art team of Jamal Eagle and John Sybil. And, you know, they carry things off pretty well. So, decent enough annual if you're following Supergirl or the Superman books already. If you're not, it's not anything that's going to set your world on fire. But, a well-executed comic book. Next is Agents of Atlas number 10, written by Jeff Parker, drawn by Gabriel Hardman and Paul Revoche, and featuring part two of Terror of the Jade Claw. Now, you remember last issue found the Agents of Atlas kind of getting their butts handed to them by the Jade Claw and her killer robot M21, I think is the number. This issue is sort of the regrouping, you know, getting all your ducks in the row before you strike back issue. And a lot of it focuses on upgrading M11, the Agents of Atlas' own killer robot. And that's a lot of fun. You get kind of the look back into the development of those androids and sort of the updated B-movie 50s technology that went into M11. There's a couple of fun sequences with an Art Bell-like conspiracy theorist radio show host, and there's one with someone who claims to be the real Venus, as in the real goddess Venus, and it ends as the Jade Claw's forces confront the Agents of Atlas. And I think next issue is going to be the last monthly issue of Agents of Atlas, and then it's going into some weird backup circumstance with an incredible Hercules, and at that point I will probably start getting it in collected form. So I'm hoping last issue doesn't end on a cliffhanger or anything like that. But, you know, for the penultimate issue of this series, I thought it was another very well done one. You know, good mix of character focus. Everybody gets a good scene. More insight into the mechanics of the Atlas Foundation and the team's role in it. And again, you know, another spotlight on M11. And, you know, I have to say, looking at this art and kind of contrasting it with the art in Cry for Justice, this, let me look at the colorist here. The colorist is Elizabeth Dismang, excuse me. And she, I guess, well, I don't know if it's the colorist or not, but the art is, it's not so much, it doesn't really have a watercolor feel, but it does have a lot of grayscale sort of effects in it. It has the appearance of being like being colored with chalk almost, and it's a nice effect. It makes it look almost painted, but obviously it's not. There are, you know, pen or pencil and ink drawings that had been colored and sort of had this effect overlaid them. But it's a nice, it has sort of a minimalist feel to it, like a David Mazzucchelli or Michael Lark, let's say. And as such, as I say, it's not really painted, but it does have a nice realistic feel to it without being sort of the over-rendered, you know, hey, look at me, I'm painted work in Cry for Justice. And it's topped off with a nice cover by Dave Johnson, who always does good work. So, shame to see this series end, but it's at least it's not going away for good. And finally, it's Batman number 690, written by Judd Winnick, penciled by Mark Bagley, and inked by Rob Hunter and Jack Purcell. And I thought this was a very good issue. It's part three of Winnick and Bagley's four-part arc about Dick Grayson's first adventure as Batman. This is mostly Dick versus Clayface. I should say Dick fighting Clayface, but really with Two-Face behind the scenes. And Winnick, I think, does an excellent job of cutting back and forth between Dick and Clayface, or excuse me, and Two-Face, and contrasting Dick's fight with Clayface and this other sort of super soldier fighter with Two-Face's manipulations. There's a little bit with the Penguin in here too, and Winnick does a good job building suspense, because Two-Face is, you know, while Dick is wearing himself out against Clayface and this other dude, Two-Face is plotting to infiltrate the Batcave and confront the new Batman when he is not expecting it. And it all builds up to a nice looking cliffhanger, actually, that recalls one of those overly symbolic Battle for the Cowl house ads, and specifically a figure, I should say, in that house ad. And honestly, a figure that I did not expect to see in the same form as he was in that house ad. But Winnick and Bagley, I think, do an excellent job together on this. Bagley is a very solid storyteller. This looks, you know, obviously I read all of Trinity, and so got a heavy dose of Bagley there. And this is a lot more energetic than his Trinity work, which I didn't think was bad by any means. But here he has fewer people in every panel on average. And so he can really devote a lot of time to who's doing what and, you know, probably change up the layouts a little bit more than he could with what he had to work with in Trinity. And again, not that Trinity was bad by any means. The upshot of this storyline is that Dick is a capable Batman, and Winnick gives us, you know, good insight into his thought process as Batman. But there is still that sense that even though Dick Grayson has been a superhero, you know, for, let's say, 20 years, there is still the sense that he is not quite as good as Batman as Bruce Wayne was, and therefore the stories are more suspenseful because there is more chance that Dick is going to screw something up, or that Dick is not going to be able to overcome what's thrown at him. And I think that lends a lot of power to what Two-Face is trying to do, because you figure that Bruce Wayne would have accounted for that somehow, and Dick is still just learning the ropes. So next issue is the last for Winnick and Bagley. Winnick will be back after Tony Daniels' six issues, and Daniels got some big shoes to fill. And with that, we bring this issue of the podcast to a close. Thanks for listening, and I will talk to you actually a little longer than a week from now, because I've got other things that I've got to do, but I'll be back eventually. Talk to you later.